all set. This is my last hurrah to you. We're going to discuss how animals can help people, and it's that's the title of it, and it's Leo Bustard for the purposes of the tape ministry. And so we got a lot of slides to cover today, so we'll be going very rapidly. What I've done is gone through my my 1,000 or 2,000 slide file and picked out about 80 of the better slides that would exhibit or that are examples of how animals have helped people. The emphasis will be on dogs, cats, and some on horses, but we'll also have birds in there and fish and something special on prison ministry. So with that introduction, we'll proceed. And I guess the first slide shows how animals are in therapy, and I've needed a lot of that this past year. One of the most famous dogs in history was Argus, who was Ulysses' dog back in very early times. And Argus was the only creature that recognized Ulysses after he came back after, I guess, over 20 years he had been gone, and he returned, and no one recognized him except his dog, who was dying and had been put on a dung heap. But he did recognize him. One of the most famous dogs in America was in the late 1800s when Oney, O-N-E-Y, I got this from the Postmaster General, the story on him, because I had heard about it, and so he filled me in on it. Oney had taken up residence in the Albany post office as a stray, and he liked to ride with the mail down to the train, and then he found out about trains, and what they would do on Oney, they would affix a tag, like in the old days, they'd put a tag on the mail bag as to where it was going to go on the railroad, you see, and they'd put that tag on Oney, and then they'd send him back to Albany. And he just loved to ride trains. And he covered the whole United States. He'd been to every state. And so then they decided to send him around the world. So they sent him from Albany over to Tacoma and put him on a steamship to Japan, China. He was given keys to a lot of these places. And he went down through England, came back to New York, and then put on a train to go back to Tacoma. I think he made the round trip in the late 1800s in about 140 days. And he was internationally recognized. And in his later years then, he attended the postal clerks conference in San Francisco. They had him there, and he was the feature of it, really. And when they introduced him, all of the attendees stood up and cheered and clapped for 15 minutes. So that's the story of Oney. Well, they took him back, and they tried to restrict his travel because he was getting very old. But he jumped a train for some town in Ohio, whereas one place I wouldn't have wanted to die, but that's what happened to him. But he's in the Smithsonian now, and you see these tags are all... They gave him an official vest because he got all these tags to put the tags on. So now you know about Oney. So if the congregation, if the conversation drags, you can just tell them about Oney. You can take your dog to do a lot of things. This is a friend of mine that trained one dog that she could trust, the white dog, to take the other one out for a run that she couldn't trust. And I know of cases where one dog would guide another dog that was blind. And they stayed together, and it was the guide dog for the other dog. And I told some of you about this. This is Dr. Levinson, one of the really grandfathers of the whole present utilization of animals to help people. And he got this started because... he was dealing on a referral basis with a lot of disturbed children. On this particular day, this This lady came an hour and a half early and caught him with his dog with him, because he always had his dog in the back room when he was expecting patients. The lady came early. She came an hour and a half early. She had a kid with a lot of trouble, and no wonder she came early. They sort of mixed it up. That is, the dog and the boy, while she was filling out the forms. And this really started Levinson out on utilizing animals to help help people. And he was very successful with this, although they made fun of him in the early days. But he was very instrumental in promoting this. He wrote a couple of books about it. One of them was dedicated to Jingles. And Boris just died just a few weeks ago. It was a tragic loss for us. He made a plea for utilization of animals in therapy and to do controlled studies on them. And Elizabeth and Sam Corson at Ohio State University Psychiatric Hospital were working on hyperkinetic dogs as a model for hyperkinetic children. And in the process, they were asked by some of the patients in other floors of the psychiatric hospital if they couldn't see the dogs. At first, they were reluctant about this, but they had very well-defined dogs, and eventually they made them available on a selection basis to some of the patients that the psychiatrist turned over to them. Of course, they turned over to them the worst cases. And I think on one study, they were successful with about 28 out of 29 utilizing animals with patients that had been refractive to any kind of other therapy. So they felt very good about this, and they were some of the pioneers in these kind of organized studies. Elizabeth and Sam ran out of money for their studies and made the dogs available, and a fellow at the Castle Nursing Home in Millersburg, Ohio, said, "We'll take these dogs," and because he had noticed how the patients and the residents in this very large facility responded to his dog when he took it around the premises. And so he took these dogs, and I'll only tell you about one of these success stories, and that was with Jed. Jed had been at this Castle Nursing Home for over 20 years. He came in, probably had a fall or something, and he was essentially aphasic. He didn't talk. He'd say a word now and then, or he'd grunt. And what happened was that Corson brought him this dog, and he said, "You brought that dog." And then he asked if he could keep the dog, and that was about the most words he'd said in 20 years. And he began then being socialized. He started drawing or tracing pictures of dogs, and then did freehand drawing on them, and you can see he drew them so both of them were laughing, and which is very significant, because in a survey done by my associate of long standing, Dr. Mike McCulloch, who's a psychiatrist in a large psychiatric practice in Portland, Oregon, he's also has a guest faculty position in both Oregon State University School of Veterinary Medicine and also in the School of Medicine at the University of Oregon. And he did a survey in which he checked on people and their response to animals. And you see that only one that was 100% was, "It helped me laugh and to maintain a sense of humor." You can read some of the others there yourself. And to continue his survey, here are some others. "Helped me cope with isolation, loneliness," and they all had pretty high scores. I was interested to read an article by Bossard in 1944, "The Mental Hygiene of Owning a Dog." This is a long time ago. In fact, it's 40 years ago. And he said it provides for an outlet for affection, serves our affectionate needs, provides an abiding relationship, contributes to development of responsibility, assists in toilet training and sex education of children, provides ego gratification, satisfies human desire for power, accustoms one to naturalness of physical processes, serves as an effective social aid, reveals an underlying neighborhood feelings, serves as an object of conversation, and offers companionship. Well, that's quite a bit. In fact, one of the things that I'm going to do when I get to be dictator, no mother will have children until she has has a preferably a large female dog. Maybe it's best if they have either a dog or cat have a litter, but have a friendly large female dog present when the children are born, and then the children are raised with this dog or dogs. They will probably be able to cope in society better. There are already some indications of this work. One of the outstanding scientists in France, Montagnier, is working on this, and the preliminary indications are that this may be the way to go. Helping dogs are very popular, of course, as guide dogs. Everybody knows about seeing eye dogs. This is a lady I met in one of the conferences in Canada. She's a professional woman, and she also is a mother, and she's blind. And this is her third guide dog. And she said, it's not only my eyes, it's my freedom. In the old days, this is Chief and her dog, Great Reluctance. But it's to remind me to tell you that in earlier times, a lot of physicians prescribed lap dogs for people. They actually write a prescription and said, you need a lap dog for abdominal problems and others. They also would prescribe a dog for someone who was going insane. They had to carry a dog around. We know now that both of these recommendations probably have a sound physiological basis and also psychological basis. I became interested in the hearing ear dog program. Well, very early on, a lady in Minneapolis, had trained her dog to hear for her, and the dog died, so she called up a local TV station and said she needed another hearing dog. And they didn't know what a hearing dog was. They said, maybe you should see the Humane Society. So she called up the Humane Society, and they didn't know what one was either. So they set up a program, but it was too big for them because, as you know, many of you who are here know that there's probably at least 16 million hearing impaired people in the United States, and many of them would benefit by having a hearing ear dog. So I became very interested in it. The American Humane Association started the program, which went well for a while, but they turned it over to other people in the recent past. But Laura Ray on the right had some responsibility for this and was their field representative. And this is Ranger and Mrs. Christensen. And I was involved in the follow-up with Laura Ray of this dog with Mrs. Christensen. She was the first recipient of a hearing dog in the Northwest. And Carol Storch, who is signing for you today, went with me and my wife on this. It was a very interesting investigation. We won't have time to go into it now. But this dog, of course, would answer the door for Mrs. Christensen. You see the orange leash there, that's a sign of a hearing dog, orange or yellow leash, or orange collar, or orange harness, as you've seen on our dog, my wife's dog, Bridget. And this was very successful. This dog wakes her up in the morning when the alarm clock goes off, tells her when the phone rings, answers the door, and also responds to smoke alarm. It also recently barked and drove off a burglar. The hearing dogs that go through from early days are trained not to bark except for intruders. They've been very successful where they've been utilized. There's now several programs in the United States where these animals are trained. A good hearing dog will cost you at least $2,000, or what we hope in many places is that various service clubs will make the investment and make them available. Here's Chief's hearing dog, Bridget. This is my time I was a fellow at the Battelle Center in Seattle. My office was overlooking this duck pond for a bird watcher. That's very distracting. And I'd look out every day and see Chief and the dog who I called Dingbat, and with the ducks out there every day, went for a walk. Here's part of the training. You see, the phone has rung, and the dog, her dog, has jumped up on her, and she is now giving it a treat. And you see the yellow leash there. Here's the lady that helped her train. We did we did what most others don't. Most people buy a hearing dog. We had a dog, and the chief didn't want to get another dog. She couldn't part with Bridget for the months that it would require to train it. So I had sent her to obedience school earlier, both she and her dog, with Terry here on the ride. And Terry heard about this, and she thought she'd want to try this. She's an expert dog trainer, and she said she'd like to take this on as a challenge. And she came in for a few minutes every day, 4 or 5 days a week for a year. And we finally got the dog certified. So the chief carries an ID card with she and the dog, and that's official in most every state now. It has the same privileges as a guide dog. For example, that's how we got it up here on the boat. I mean, they have to let you take it. I mean, they didn't give us any static. Well, they said we didn't know about it, although I always write to them and call them ahead of time. But the person at the end of the line doesn't often know about that. But they didn't give us any bad time about it. But it's very important to her as a companion. But it does all the things that I told you it did for Miss Christensen's. You can also train him to answer if there's a crying baby or for emergency vehicle sirens or for buzzers and things like that. So they can be sort of made to order. This is one of the more moving things I've been involved in. I was invited to open the British Small Animal Veterinary Association last year in London. It's the largest meeting of veterinarians in Europe. And before the conference, they had a press conference. And I had been in England to talk to them about this, several times, I guess, but 3 years before, and I suggested it to of their leaders that they ought to start a hearing ear dog program, which they did. And they have an outstanding program. And at this press interview, or press conference, they had brought in Mr. and Ms. Chapman here, who have been hearing impaired since birth. And they run a school. They're in charge of a school for the hearing impaired in Devon. They're not. It's really a school or a home for disturbed hearing impaired children. And so this dog was then introduced to them for the first time and had been selected preliminary, and now it was going into intensive training and then would be placed to them. And I told them, they asked me to present the hearing ear dog case. And so I told them about hearing ear dogs and about how, in the case of my wife who has a hearing ear dog, or Miss Christensen, it is a dog to serve only them. Here it will serve a couple, but also the remarkable possibilities of what it'll do for these disturbed children, you see. So it was one of the few press interviews, and I've had press interviews in Europe and Australia and New Zealand and United States and Canada. And very seldom do you have an applause by the press corps. But they applauded after that, because it was a very emotionally charged thing, and they could see, the perceptive ones could see, the possibilities. This is an interesting case. It's very important to select the right animal. A human-animal interrelationship can be disaster, or it can be remarkably effective. It's a matter of selection, the right one. Now, this isn't the dog you would select for a family. The story on this dog is that it was a very disturbed dog, and they brought it intentionally into a home for delinquent teenage girls. And they told the girls, "We have a dog for you that has been beaten, starved, mistreated, unloved, and you are to socialize it and bring it back into society." Now, there wasn't a girl there that couldn't identify with this, because that was their problem, too. And they did socialize it and brought it back into society, and it had a remarkable effect on them. It had a remarkable effect on them as well as on the dog. So it was socialized in the process. This is an interesting study by a friend of mine in England named Hutton. He's a social worker. He's done several nice studies. This is one he just reported in October at the International Congress in Vienna. And he shows, and I have to make this short, but he looked at the various values up on the right of companionship, love and loyalty, attention, affection, improved relations, enjoyment, communication. And he evaluated that for parents, family, the family's own children, and then foster children. What he was really studying here is how would an animal's presence in a home affect foster children. And it turned out that it was very beneficial to them as if they were properly placed. And it meant a very great deal to them to have those present. It made life easier in a difficult situation. This is an interesting one. This lady on the right was, that's her dog there, was a counselor in our university counseling center. And she often used her dog in this situation. And the presence of a dog changes the whole milieu of the interview, especially if they're animal people. They're easier to talk to. They're more prone to talk and discuss issues. It's a safer situation for them. That's why I have recommended in many instances that people in interview situations have an animal present. I know a psychiatrist who didn't have a receptionist. He had two large friendly dogs in his reception room. And when people called up for an interview, he would tell them that he didn't have a receptionist right now, but he had a couple of dogs in the waiting room that were very friendly. And they should just sit down and then they'd be called. And he'd watch them through a small opening to see how things were going with them and the dogs. And he felt that they were easier to deal with after a period of therapy with the dog. I won't give you his name. This is in Denmark. This is one of my favorite pictures. This fellow obviously has a close bond here. And the one that's riding shotgun is wearing the goggles that day. That's a very great picture. A happy couple. And probably true for him as it is for many people. That dog is probably the most important thing in his life. Because it gives him companionship. Gives him unconditional love. It makes him feel needed. It socializes him, gives him security, or probably helps organize his life, and something to touch. There are no pills available that'll do that for you today. This is a kind of a sad story. This is Jack and Rags. Jack is a Blackfeet Indian on the Blackfeet Reservation. We have a Blackfeet on our faculty. He's a very good painter. This is not one of his better paintings, but it's the best one he had on the human-animal bond. He's quite a famous painter. He has quite a few shows. But this is Jack and Rags. They're in real life. And one night on the reservation, Jack, they were inseparable. But on this particular night, Jack said he had to go to town, and it was about 60 degrees below miserable. So he thought it wasn't a place for Rags. He thought Rags would be at risk. So he went to town, and on the way home he got feeling bad and he sat down and froze to death. And they did make arrangements for Rags, but probably if he had Rags along, he might have survived. It's an interesting story here with Marjorie Grinnell. She used to help select dogs for this guide dog program. And she lived alone, and she always had Airedales. She was now 82 years old, and her last Airedale died. And her physician at that time says, "No more dogs for you, Marjorie, because you're going to trip over them, break a hip, and then that's the end of you." And she just started going downhill. And one day she happened to be on the street and met an old friend of hers who was also a physician, very compassionate, understanding physician. And he was very frank with Marjorie. He said, "You know, He said, you don't look very well. Obviously, he wasn't. She was losing ground. And she says, yes, I don't feel good, and my doctor doesn't want me to get another dog because he's afraid I'll trip. Well, her friend said, I think you ought to get another dog. And she was, within a few hours, she was down at the Humane Society in San Francisco and got Bruce here, who's a golden retriever. It's kind of hard to go wrong in a golden retriever. And so if you would have gone into her room, in her bedroom, on her single bed, would be she in the middle, Bruce on the right, and Coco the cat on the left. And although it was a very rambunctious dog, he always stayed clear of her. No danger of tripping, because he was sensitive to this, you see. Animals, many of them, have a great awareness for this, as Bruce did. So her physical condition, you probably measured, was improved by the presence of Bruce. So she was happy until she died. I show you this Basset Hound. We make evaluations, or my associates do, in certain nursing homes and convalescent homes. We've developed guidelines for this. And one of the places we did this was at the Tacoma Lutheran Home. And in some situations, we may go in and say, a dog shouldn't be utilized here. And that's part of the slide set we use for this. But I bring out this Basset Hound to tell you about another Basset Hound named Audrey. I had a very sad letter one day from a lady, and she told me about her mother, who had been born in Europe and learned German first. She came to this country and used only English and spent most of her entire life in the United States. When she got old, she had what by her letter, I would assume was Alzheimer's or senile dementia. She wasn't really with it. And she said about her mother that one day, the Basset Hound that lived down the street happened to come into the house, and she came over to her mother. Now, I should tell you that her mother had been over 2 years reverted to German and never spoke English. And when the Basset Hound came up to her, she leaned down and petted it and says, "Nice puppy, are you hungry?" It's the first English she'd used in over 2 years. And her daughter went on to say, in fact, she says, I guess I should have gotten her a dog, because the only time she spoke English was when the dog was there. But now she's dead. And she was right. I can give you other examples of that where on aphasics are helped by this. What I'm tried to do with our students was to have them learn to know an old person as a person. We have a visitation program in local nursing homes where they take animals maybe some area in the nursing home where they congregate and discuss things. But I and others have encouraged them to go and visit a given person with their animal on a routine basis, so they learn to know an old person as a person. And this is one of those cases where this student has brought brought a dog to this fellow, and he looks forward to these visits very much. And I feel that it's very helpful, not only to the person, but also to the dog and also to the student. Especially in veterinary medicine, they see very few handicapped, and they don't see very many old people, and they need this kind of exposure. I was very pleased to see that in the American Journal of Care for the Aging, that in geriatric nursing, here's a lady with two dogs, and more nurses are recognizing this. They're often the first ones to recognize in their compassion the value of this. Irene Mertensen Burnside, who some of you nurses may know from her books and all, is very keen about this. And so is my friend Suzanne Robb. Suzanne Robb is a nurse and also a PhD, and she is doing studies at the Veterans Hospital in Pittsburgh on a grant to look at the the value of dogs for some of her patients. She has been a board member of the Delta Society for the Study of the Human-Animal Bond. More and more, when people ask me, especially people who live alone, ask me about what kind of an animal they should get, I usually say, no, what two animals should you get? Because if they live alone, or if they're living alone and gone a lot, it's important the animals to have a companion during the absence, and they get in usually less mischief that way. But in this case, with Pat here, we recommended, because her animal was very old, she get another younger one. And after a few weeks, the dog, after having its nose bent for a couple of weeks, it really accommodated for the younger animal, and in fact probably extended his lifespan because it seemed to sort of get more active. And so it can be helpful in those situations. There are a few situations when this wouldn't work, but this really worked here, and I think it'll work in many situations. The other thing about it is, and a very critical issue, is that when the old dog died, it wasn't as difficult for her to face the grief because she still had another animal that she was responsible for and that depended on her. And I have recent experience with a case where I'm sure this lady would have taken her own life when her cat Lala died, but she had other cats to take care of. And she told me that she wanted to kill herself. This is a case where a physician wrote a prescription for Walter here for a dog. We got a call from the nursing home, said we got a prescription for a dog, and so you got to help us find a dog. So we got Boo for him after going through about five other dogs. And it really made him happier. It's the only thing that the physician thought would help him, and he was probably right. And so we had to make provisions. Fortunately, the nursing home was... Convalescent home was very understanding. They cut a hole in the wall of the thing to provide for a run for Boof so he could go in and out because the person couldn't get out of bed. And it was a very successful placement. We've gone into school system. I think it's very important that we introduce school children today to in a course in responsible pet care, realizing the importance of animals. If you analyze your own school systems, you'll probably find that there isn't very much offered on animals. That's probably why today that the majority of the companion animal owning public are irresponsible pet owners. In too many places today, animals are a throwaway item. And we gotta quit that. We have to show respect and reverence for them. So our students go into the nursing homes. I mean, not only nursing homes, but they go into the school system in a very organized curriculum. And it's probably the most, it's the best evaluated program in the curriculum of the schools, elementary school system, from kindergarten through the sixth grade. We're now packaging this under a grant from Hill's Packing Company, Hill's Pet Food Company. And here it's nice, you've got a big dog, you can have about five kids on one dog. And it's important that they touch the animals. It's a very successful program. And here, recalling what old Joseph said many years ago, one of the big rewards of having loved dogs all your life is the fact that you will be spared a lonely old age as a result of your continuing attention. And there's really two populations that really could benefit by animals, and that's the young and the old. And it's a hard sell on an old person if they've never had that experience before. And then in choosing animals, if you don't know what kind of animal to get, dachshunds are ideal dogs for small children as they are already stretched and pulled to such a length that the child cannot do much harm one way or another. They're not always the best dog to place, however. But they don't shed very much, and they're very smart. Now I'll talk a little bit about cats. If humanity could be crossed with a domestic cat, it would improve us but diminish the cat. Mark Twain and a lot of cat lovers said that. That's one of our veterinary students. My experience with this is, I still have this Raleigh bike. I bought it new in 1950 when I was with General Electric Company, and I used to pedal my bike a couple of miles every day to work or home. And I was just leaving the bus lot one day, and my friend pulled up alongside me with his car, and he had a back seat full of cats. His wife had put her foot down and says, "You got to get rid of some of these cats." And so he was on his way to the animal control center, and he says, "Boy, there's you got animals, but you don't have your kids don't have a cat. What they need is a cat," he said. So he picked out the best one, and so that's the cat in that paper sack. I was brown bagging it then too. So I went rolling on home, and one of the motivation many things for me was that our oldest child, his son, Buzz, we called him Buzz before he was born even, and he was hardly ever in bed. He was always buzzing around. Well, he wasn't buzzing right now because he'd been sick, very sick for a couple of days. In fact, when I came in with his cat in his bag, he didn't even raise his head from the pillow. So I just dropped off the bag in his room on his bed. And it wasn't long before I heard noise out there, and they were having a great time. And by noon the next day, he was back in school, almost fully recovered. I can't explain. Well, I guess I could probably explain why, but it was a remarkable recovery. We placed the animals about 10 years ago in some nursing homes in Moscow, Idaho. We went to Idaho because they didn't have the restrictions on it that some of the people in the state of Washington had. In fact, one of the cats is still there. It was named Geriatrics, and now it is. But there's an interesting story also behind this. There was a fellow who was living alone in Whitman County, outside of Pullman. He was living on, Boston cream pies and Twinkies. And it was a miserable kind of thing. And he finally went in a state of anorexia, really. I mean, he was really in bad shape. Or inanition, really. He was starving, and he was going to die. They brought him to the hospital and got him partially stabilized, but they didn't think that he was a very good risk. So they brought him to the local convalescent home, and the only way they could make him he wouldn't take nourishment. The only way they'd tie his arms down, and then feed him intravenously, and then he'd fight to get the tubes out. And he was uncooperative. But they thought he had some spunk left, so one day they had some cats in this place, and they couldn't find the cats. And they finally ended up in his room, and they lifted up the covers, and there were three young cats. So a wise worker there said to him, "We're going to take these cats away, and Andy, you can get them back if you cooperate with us and take nutrition." And so it was on a reward basis. And in a very short time, he gained 45 pounds because he had this as a reward, you see. And he cooperated with them. And if you'd have gone in there a month later, you would have seen him rolling around in a wheelchair in that convalescent home with a blanket over him. And under the blanket were three partially anoxic cats. So, and there wasn't anybody in that nursing home that wouldn't say that they saved his life. Otherwise, he would have died. This is another interesting case. This is Marie. Marie had a stroke and wasn't responding to anything. She also had sores on her legs that wouldn't heal. And so we decided with the convalescent home to set up a therapy room and put Handsome the cat in it. And then they could vote who should go in there. They voted for Marie. So they brought her in there. And whenever she started scratching her legs, the cat would, of course, jump on her. Thought she was playing with her, you see. So she quit scratching her sores, and they healed up in about 5 weeks. You and I could have written prescriptions probably from here to Kingdom Come and wouldn't have done anything about it. And she'd also socialized her. And here you see her, you would hardly know her, it's the same woman 2 months later. She was even on TV on PM Magazine. And here's one of the visitors for the cat. It's a dog that came to visit her. This is a cat, I forgot now. Well, yeah, these animals have great capabilities. This is one that was taught to use a John. It's one for those of you in the grief session yesterday, that spook, and he died at 4 and a half. And it was a very grievous kind of thing for this lady that had him. She's a scientist, Dr. Seglin.
That's enough for that. There's a lot of diversity in cats. We've placed some cats with terminally ill people that have special sensitivity so that they don't die alone. If you can have something purring, warm, that you can touch on your breast in your terminal illness, that's the way I'd like to go out. And it has been successful. I got the idea from St. Christopher's Hospice in London. This is a picture out of St. Christopher's where Dame Cicely Saunders operates. And there's an animal that's visiting her master, who is terminal. There is also some resident animals in this hospice, which is considered probably one of the leading hospices. It sort of set the pattern for hospices in the world. Dame Cicely Saunders was given an award for this. She was also knighted for her work on pain. She gave him the Templeton Award, which is bigger than the Nobel Prize, $220,000, 3 years ago. 2 years ago, I guess, the year after Mother Teresa got it. In my own experience, my father really never gave up to the mechanical age. As long as he was on the farm, he had a horse. Often wondered why he had the horse, but he always hitched it up when our children came. And they'd always have to go out to the woods to get some more wood. I went behind the woodshed, and I think he had enough wood there to last him for 3 years. But he always had to go to the woods with the kids. It was probably therapeutic for him, and it was certainly meant a lot to our children. We have not forgotten this. I told you about Karn last night. That's Karn, little girl there. Becky is not there yet. It's partnership in equine therapy and education. What horseback riding will do for a person is truly remarkable. There's a lot of work that has to be done on this. In Germany, Scandinavian, England, they're far ahead of us. But there's an international organization on this, and also many organizations in this country. And we have a university program, although poorly funded. I mean, it's just what we can get people to give us. But we've seen some remarkable, remarkable things happen to these.
A friend of mine worked at Camp Easterseal West in Bombay, and they have a very involved horse riding therapy program that's really overseen by a physical therapist, and
yes.
They made great progress.
Yeah. Yeah, you can use it. They've even used it in speech therapy, for aphasics. And you can imagine, if you're a child, been in a wheelchair all your life, looking up, and you're suddenly vaulted on a horse, going places you've never been before, and riding and looking down on people, it has a remarkable effect on you. And there's also physiological effects to this, some of them probably not fully defined. This person is an old person. We have programmed not only for the mentally retarded, but also the physically impaired. That has been highly successful. This is my wife's aunt, Vinnie, when she was 85, riding a horse that's about the same age. The Diamond Center for Riding for the Handicapped in the south of London is the biggest one in the world. They have over 715 signed up to ride each week. It's on the grounds of St. Mary's Hospital for Children. And this is one of the big days I had when I went out with the lady on the right, who's Jean Hyatt, who runs her own program, has a program for riding for the handicapped Liverpool, which I've also visited. Her husband's a very famous veterinarian. And this was a fantastic day that I had there. And they told me an interesting story about this girl. This girl loved to ride horses, and it was very helpful to her, but she contracted cancer, and it was terminal cancer, and so she could no longer ride, but she was at St. Mary's Hospital, and they put her on the first floor, and on good days, they would bring her horse over, her favorite horse over, and they'd open the windows, and then the horse would stick its head in so she could pet it and give it carrots or something. This was very meaningful for her during her terminal illness. We hired Bob. He was a quadriplegic, and then he became paraplegic. And we hired him for a reason, not only that we felt he had some promise because he's very bright, but also that I wanted our students to be introduced to someone who is in a wheelchair was an enormous person. Because most people, as I said, in veterinary school, for example, don't know a handicapped person as a person. And one of the things Bob wanted to do was to drive for the, have a, drive a horse. There was no way that he could probably ride a horse. But he was looking forward to, we were trying to develop a, the right kind of vehicle so that he could roll his wheelchair onto it and then ride a horse and go out riding it. And now there are some vehicles like this, and there are some driving programs. So, and really another thing I'm going to do when I get to be dictator is when one of the traumatic things that happens to an old person is that you lose your driver's license, and it sort of kills part of you. Well, I'm going to fix it up so you have, you go back to livery stable so you can check out a horse in the wagon. You know, an old person can check them out, and they can go and visit their old girlfriends and go to the store, go to church. And the horse usually knows where you're going in a way, and you don't have to have a driver's license. It's something about riding a horse and touching that is probably very important and therapeutic, but it's not fully defined. In Beta Stolen, this has been very useful, and up on the Valdres in Norway, using physical therapy, but also riding, and also having dogs present. Very, very successful. Dogs and cats aren't the only animals that can be helpful. This happens to be in Dillon, Montana. This girl wanted to raise a 4-H lamb. So she went down to a local nursing home where they had plenty of land, and she raised this sheep as a prize sheep for the 4-H. But the payoff was that the nursing home in Dillon, Montana is full of old retired sheep herders. And she got more on sheep than probably she bargained for, but they were out there telling her just what to do. And the best combination for an old person is a youngster and a child and an animal. If you really want a therapeutic regimen, that's what you have access. You have them have access to that. In this particular case, the a stockman in Australia heard about this, and he was so impressed with it, he bid highest for the lamb and then gave it back to the nursing home. This fellow lives on Tiger Mountain near Issaquah. Very unusual fellow. And he sent me this picture of him and his pet cow at 32 years of age. It had just died. It was a very old cow. You can imagine what kind of a bond this is. This fellow had had this animal for all those years. It's longer than most people are married. And you can be sure that he cried when this animal died. Birds are also very good. And this is a pigeon. It was the most checked out item in the park system in Portland. This is a handicapped piano player that plays there at the park sometimes. And when he does, this handicapped pigeon gets up and makes up its own dance steps when the dancers come on. Probably helping out people. This is a very unusual day for me. I was in Sydney, and I was on a whirlwind tour, on the subject of the human-animal bond, and in interviews with radio, television, and newspapers. And I got off early one day. They allowed me to go off early so I could go birding out in West Sydney. And so I went out. I was to meet this lady, and she showed me around. She was an expert birder. And she, before the end of the day, she said, well, from 3 o'clock, she says, we have to go over and see something that I've never seen, but I've heard about it. We want to go over and see this lady that feeds birds over in this village before 5:15. So we went over there, and I met Marjorie Sykes. Here she is with all her birds. She's about 75 years old. She feeds birds every morning at 7 and every afternoon. She's been doing it every day for 12 years. She had a real collection of birds, and she was really a bright person, and I had a wonderful visit with her. She said when she's late in the morning, sometimes the birds come after and land on her hat and her shoulders. And I saw a lot of birds there in one place. And I'm sure that that probably helps her survive, and she certainly is needed. At least the birds think so. There was a study on what budgerigars, which are Australian parrots, will do for an older person. A friend of mine named Roger Mugford did this study in Yorkshire in England. He went out to old people living alone that were 75, 80 years old, and he divided them into three groups. Some of them he gave begonias to, some he gave budgies to, and some he gave nothing to. They profiled them before, and then in 5 months, they visited them every month. I'm here to tell you that the budgies won hands down, but begonias are better than nothing. So the take-home lesson is give them budgies and begonias. And some of them built these remarkable playgrounds for their budgies. And although the study was concluded after 5 months, they went out and checked on them. Some of them still had their budgies out at 18 months. They had all given them endearing names, and they were very important to them. I wish I had time to tell you more about this. When I was interviewed by Carol Thatcher, when I was in London 2 years ago on a talkback program, Carol Thatcher's mother is highly placed in London. And this lady called in who had trained her budgie to be a seeing eye budgie for her. It was very interesting. This fellow, I should tell you, that fellow watches those fish tank, that fish tank up to 4 hours a day in a nursing home. Very meaningful for him. We know now from my friends at the University of Pennsylvania, two of them are here, they did studies on aquarium and found out that people's blood pressure falls in the presence of when they watch a fish in aquarium. In fact, they've done a study now in dental offices and found that the level of stress is lower if you have an aquarium present. Frogs. I was on the, I interviewed several times, but one of the times I was on the, I think it was Seattle Tonight Show, Klinger, and I mentioned that people should have access to something that's furred, finned, or feathered. And one of the ladies, some lady up on San Juan Islands wrote to me, and she says, I was kind of taken aback that you limited the access to those that are furred, finned, and feathered. She says, I have a couple of tree frogs that are very important to me. So I wrote back to her and told her that the finest fur I know is frog fur. I'm very interested in animals in prison, since I'd served time in prison myself, and I befriended a person who had been incarcerated 35 times in 14 different institutions to help her out. One of the pioneers in this, in the present time, is Don Lee, and David Lee, I mean, on the left. He's in a Lima State Prison for the criminally insane in Lima, Ohio. He's had remarkable success. It's kind of a earned right to have access to animals there, and it's really changed things. There's far less strife, and the people have been really humanized a great deal. And it appears that the level of drugs required to keep some of them on an even keel is less in the presence of animals. Small animals, birds and gerbils and stuff. Here's one of the prisoners here. I noted the same thing at Lorton Prison in Washington, D.C., which is a maximum security prison which I've visited. And if you ask the prisoners there, what does the animal do for you? They say, it takes the anger out of me. And I was perfectly at ease, as was Linda Hines, when we made a presentation there with these maximum security prisons. We felt at ease because they each had an animal. Here's Kathy, the person I told you about. I encouraged her. She's not chair-bound or wheelchair-bound, but I encouraged her to train animals to help people in wheelchairs. Here's her dog, Aaron. And that she can train a dog to do almost anything. I've seen it deliver all kinds of things to her, including glasses, spectacles, hammers, blankets, pills. Here she's the dog is handing her a paper for a person that wouldn't be able to use their hands. And she was the one that came up with the idea. We had talked a lot about prisons and what to do about it. And she says, why don't we go out to Purdy Prison for the maximum security prison for women? And we'll go out with expert trainers, and have them train animals to help handicapped people. And although we're in the early phases of it, it's had remarkable success. And really delightful things have happened, not only to the prisoners like this one, who is a contract killer in for life. She's now in charge of the dog colony there that we had given as a gift by an unnamed donor. And she works 4 to 6 hours a day with these animals. And she's very, very bright and is doing a great job. And when she turned over her dog to Bert Push, who was in charge of an independent living center at Puyallup, she choked up. Contract killers usually don't choke up. And I could give you other stories about this. Here's some of the trainers and some of the prisoners. I brought this picture in because it's to remind me to tell you about a very moving thing. I spoke recently at the University of Tennessee at their anniversary, and the head of clinics came up to me afterwards, and he said, and I'd known him before, he says, you know, our students and I, we service the animals, the farm animals in the various prisons in this state. He says, I was recently at a prison in West Tennessee, and they have a large hog colony there, and I'd been there before. And the chief fellow that's taking care of the hogs had been in this prison for 32 years. And he wanted to talk to him. And the reason he wanted to talk to him, he says, I've been here for 32 years, and now they're going to let me out. Couldn't you help me have them keep me here? Because I can't face life without these pigs.
What did they do for him?
Pardon? Well, they're good companions to him. Well, I don't know yet. This just happened a few weeks ago. Yeah. And here is what we're facing in this country. We're facing an overwhelming problem of taking care of old people, with fewer people contributing to the fund to take care of these people. So we are in deep trouble. And I'm about finished up here, so. And I think that animals could help a lot, keeping people independent in their home longer, and therapy in many cases, reducing the number of staff in many of the nursing homes, because if you have animals, they don't bug the staff as much, and they're happier about it. We've addressed some of this quite a few years ago in our book on animals, Aging and the Aged. Guidelines for nursing homes, I'm going to leave a copy here in the library. It's in its second printing now. We're facing an increasing complex technological society. Computers are unforgiving. And so I've invented the pet computer. It's a computer that when you're in trouble, that it's got hair on it, and you can turn it on, and it's warm, and it has a wet tongue. But it's a cheaper way to go, and that's just to get an animal in the computing room. It's nice having someone waiting for you when you get home. To Dr. Busted, best wishes from Jim Davis.
Oh.
A friend is one who comes in when the whole world goes out. This is a lady I told you about. She was in the worst prison camp of the war, lost her husband as a result of it, her child. She was an honor student at UCLA. In fact, she's on the Stanford Gifted Children program since she was a kid. And she wrote me this letter and told me that the cat is what saved her life. She was going to commit suicide, and she found the cat, which was Lala. And then it got sick quite a ways later, but she had other cats. And then her folks died. And then she lost her job and got mammary carcinoma, and also lost what little money she had. So I had my friends in California take care of her cats. This letter, it's one of the most remarkable letters I've ever received. I was going to share it with you, but I don't have time now. But it was enclosed in this card. And it was really, really grabbed me. I know her now as a person, a remarkable person, probably one of the brightest people I know. And she's been an agnostic, and she just wrote and said she's going to the Crystal Church. I'll finish up here. That's the dogma for today. Winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the Lord is heard in our land. We need a reverence for life. If you don't take anything back from here, we have to quit. We have to respect our environment, our animals, and treat them. And I tell our students they must not only have capable hands, but gentle words and caring hearts. To cure sometimes, to relieve often, to comfort always. That's what appears in Mail House. And that's all. Thank you.